Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Appalachian Bigfoot by Dr. Russell Jones, narrated by Kevin T. Collins. Foreword: Matt Moneymaker and Cliff Barockman. The subject of Bigfoot field research, i.e. not just the collecting of newspaper articles, is roughly 60 years old now in 2021. Roughly half of that period occurred prior to the Internet. Bigfoot field research in the Appalachian mountain range did not begin in earnest until well after 2000. Only a few investigators like Sam Sherry went into the field prior to 2000 in Appalachia. There have been a few conferences for Bigfoot field researchers in Pennsylvania over the past two decades, but it's a small scene compared to Ohio. There is a book with old newspaper clippings from Pennsylvania from the late 1800s and early 1900s describing encounters with these creatures, but nothing else in book form focusing on Pennsylvania Bigfoot research into the modern era. The author of this book, Dr. Russ Jones, wrote the one and only book about Bigfoot research and sightings in West Virginia, so he is the obvious person to write the book about Bigfoot sightings and research for the whole Appalachian range. Russ has led Bigfoot field research efforts in Ohio and West Virginia, and he has been involved with the BFRO for many years. Consequently, he carries most of the accumulated knowledge about how these creatures operate in general, and where these creatures have been spotted in the Appalachia. Russ urges me to write a book myself about Bigfoot field research to document everything I've learned over the years. I've toyed with the idea, but I already post a lot on the BFRO website, so it always seemed redundant. However, when I read this book about Appalachian Bigfoots, I realized how much knowledge and insight, behavioral and geographical, has been gathered over the decades that I had forgotten or almost forgotten, much of which I taught Russ years ago. It all still holds true, and it is so good to see it in print, in book form. Be glad that you have access to it. The Bigfoots in Appalachia are not going away, and the information contained herein will not be obsolete anytime soon. Matt Moneymaker. Over the course of my 27 years of Bigfoot research, I have had the opportunity to visit 46 states and 5 continents in pursuit of Sasquatches. As one can imagine, I have met a huge number of people in these travels. Some of these people loudly proclaim themselves to be Bigfoot researchers, but few, in my opinion, have risen to this lofty claim. Dr. Russ Jones is one of these few. I have always been struck with Russ's quiet demeanor, never making his research about himself, but always keeping his eyes on the prize, learning about Sasquatches. The best woodsmen know that to be familiar with any animal, one needs to be knowledgeable about not only that animal, but all the others and the environment in which they live. No animal, not even Sasquatches, are isolated, but rather integral parts of a larger ecosystem. To these ends, Russ has furthered his own research by becoming a certified naturalist in his state. When television productions, Bigfoot researchers, or Bigfoot enthusiasts go to West Virginia, Russ is always one of the first researchers to receive the call for help. Having worked as a BFRO investigator for many years, he knows more witnesses in his region of the country than anyone else. His knowledge of the habitat is intimate. His intelligence can be seen in his work, as well as his creativity in deploying novel techniques and experiments. He puts more time and effort into his studies than anyone else I am aware of in his part of the country. I was honored to be asked to write the foreword for his first book back in 2015. Having been asked again does not lessen the honor, rather, it amplifies it. Russ has become a good friend over the years and is one of my inner circle with whom I discuss my own research openly. I actively seek his advice and knowledge in my own work and value what he shares. Through this book, Russ is sharing his knowledge with you. It is a rare thing to sit at the feet of someone as experienced as Russ. Take what he says to heart, and know, as I do, that you are hearing the thoughts and experiences of a lifelong investigator. Cliff Barachman, November 2021. Preface. I have been interested in Bigfoot since I was a young man and believe that I have had encounters with the creature. While not seeing the creature in the clear, prolonged way I desire, I have heard noises, sometimes even aggressive noises, found hair, and have found footprints. None of the animals of Appalachia are capable of producing what I have found. It gave me a hunger and thirst for Bigfoot knowledge when I finally came to believe what the answer was. I have a bachelor's degree in science. My doctor's degree is in chiropractic. I am a certified master naturalist, so my background makes me come at things from a science perspective, but with my consideration of a lifetime as an outdoorsman. I was fortunate to grow up in one of those families that hunted anything and everything from plants to animals. My standard to believe is high. I know that this can frustrate some witnesses and other researchers. I just believe that people are biased in how they see things, wanting to see what they want in many cases. I also believe that if you are going to claim that a large primate exists that hasn't been found yet, or a body procured, then it's a huge claim, and the evidence procured must be the same, and you should err on the side of caution. Nonetheless, come with me on this journey. Come with an open mind and an honest cynicism. It's fine to question the concerns you have and share your doubts, you should, but it's intellectually dishonest to not consider all the evidence. Introduction. Much of the Appalachian landscape resembles the Pacific Northwest: steep, remote mountains and lush, water-filled valleys. Of course, the Pacific Northwest is the most common region for Bigfoot sightings, so why would it surprise us that the region on the East Coast, most resembling it, would be renowned historically for Bigfoot sightings? For the purposes of this book, I will be considering Appalachia to be how it was defined originally by the federal government in 1964 during the War on Poverty. The War on Poverty was proposed by President Lyndon Johnson during the State of the Union, in which the aim was to not only relieve the symptoms of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, prevent it. It included Medicaid, Medicare, the Food Stamp Act, the Economic Opportunity Act, Job Corps, and Head Start. It included the following states: Pennsylvania, Maryland, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, South Carolina, Alabama, and Georgia. Later, as more money became involved, more states were added, many not having anything to do with Appalachia. In terms of Bigfoot, Appalachia, and this book, I will be choosing the five states with the greatest number of sightings in the region and therefore representative of the region. The more traditional Appalachian states, if you will. It by no means implies that Bigfoot is not found in relatively large numbers outside the Appalachian footprint on the East Coast, or in other parts of the states that a portion of which fall into the Appalachian footprint. It will go something like this. I will visit many of the states to look around in person in the area that they have a lot of historical Bigfoot sightings. I will interview what I consider the best or most active Bigfoot researchers through Appalachia. I will try to give you a feel of what it's like to be in the woods in Appalachia, or give you an idea of where to go. The Appalachian Mountains themselves are roughly 1,500 miles long and 450 million years old. Though now averaging just 3,000 feet in height, the Appalachians were once as tall as the Rocky Mountains and the Alps. They are among the oldest mountains on planet Earth. Also, for the purpose of this book, I'm assuming that Bigfoot exists. For much of my life, I would have told you that I'm 95% sure type of thing. I would have said, until I saw one dead on the ground, I won't be sure. I've moved past all that, and it only seems fair to be honest and clear about it. Somewhere along the thousands of interviews and tens of thousands of hours in the woods, I became certain. More on that later. 1. Bigfoot in Appalachia. The Beginning. If there is anywhere in North America it exists outside of the Pacific Northwest, it's in Appalachia. Many of us believed for many years that it could only be in the Pacific Northwest. That area makes sense, of course, because whatever Bigfoot may be, it came across the Bering Strait 10,000 to 20,000 years ago. Appalachia is a largely remote area where the morning fog eerily hangs in the hollows. Steep, forbidden mountainsides that in many places are inaccessible, that just make you feel like Bigfoot belongs there. Sure, there are large cities in Appalachia. Think Asheville, Birmingham, Chattanooga, and Knoxville, among others. Even within a half hour or so of the largest Appalachian cities, you can be in a remote area that makes it hard to believe that a large city is anywhere near. It's easy for people to believe or assume that Bigfoot is a myth. Never in our history have we, as a society, spent less time outdoors. We are largely afraid of the dark, getting lost, the animals out there, not to mention snakes. During many interviews or podcasts that I do, it's common for me to hear, "It seems like if something like that is out there, then someone would have found them by now." I always want to ask who someone is. There's no one out there. Of course, I have proof of this on all of my game cameras. Appalachia in places is very remote. I literally went years in West Virginia without seeing people on one of my game cameras, with the exception of the cameras that I put out on trails and trailheads, in order to get an idea of how many people were using a particular trail. In Ohio, it's hard to find a place where at least a couple of times a year someone doesn't meander past. I remember one camera that I placed in West Virginia's New River Gorge. I had to drive to a remote, dead-end road, hike a mile on a seldom-used trail, then up a steep mountainside off-trail that takes an hour to get a quarter mile. If I took you there, you wouldn't believe a person would ever be there. I was covering a flat on a mountainside with this particular camera, a flat being a flat part of a hill or mountainside. Sometimes there are several on the hill or mountainside before you reach the top of the hill or ridge, as it may be called. I would move the camera along the flat, on top of the flat, on the bottom of the flat, with the sun, against the sun. I believed in the past that I had heard a Bigfoot sound in that area before, so I was trying anything to come up with a Bigfoot picture if one came through the area again. Well, you guessed it, after a year, no Bigfoot pic, but I got one of an older gentleman staring at my camera. You go places deep and remote, and you should assume that others may as well. The small percentage of our society that is actually out there seldom ventures farther than a quarter mile from a road or trail, and that's even been documented. Myths seem to fit and be natural in Appalachia. Appalachia's population is largely stagnant in most areas. The residents are older than the average nationally. They are less educated and racially diverse than the general population in the rest of the country. Heck, if you visit our fairs, you will find that we even have storytelling competitions. For a city dweller who seldom ventures into the wilderness, a stereotype is formed, which in turn can make it easier to discard a subject out of hand. That Bigfoot doesn't exist in their city or environment, but rather in an area they seldom go. Maybe their perception of the people living there doesn't lend itself to serious consideration or even a conversation. Let's face it. People are busy with their lives, jobs, families, and who follows the happenings in Bigfoot world enough to be educated on it? Most would be surprised that there's people who actually do. In the end, seeing or sometimes hearing is believing, and if you aren't there, and if Bigfoot doesn't live where you do, then it's hard to imagine one existing. Interestingly, nationally, about a third of the residents of North America believe in Bigfoot. The thing about that is it includes Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, and all the other enormous cities where Bigfoot doesn't live near. In the Pacific Northwest or Appalachia, the percentage believing in Bigfoot can be as high as 75%. Almost any hunter or outdoorsman in those regions has a strange story or a friend with one. As I have mentioned before, I want to believe. Does that mean I can't be scientific and objective? No, of course not. It's a romantic notion to believe that there are things out there left to be discovered. I crave the lonely, isolated, and solitary places. What better thing is there than if a Bigfoot is there, and to have the excuse to walk there looking for evidence and hoping against all odds for an encounter? 2. Where are the bones? You can't talk about Bigfoot without figuring out how they get their food. An average-size adult Bigfoot is larger than an average-size adult male human and requires more calories. Also, the average human is much less active than a Bigfoot would be, spending much of the day hunting or scavenging for food. This is one of the first questions I considered when I became interested in Bigfoot. Is there enough food around to support this animal? A bear takes a lot of food, but in some places may hibernate 6 months. Would looking at an orangutan or gorilla be commensurate in this aspect? I acknowledge that after looking at this issue, it's only a concern in colder weather areas. Today, for instance, as I write this, it's in the 20s Fahrenheit, snowing and a couple of inches on the ground already. Being an outdoorsman, I know that most of the game is lying low and not active until the storm is over. My guess here is that Bigfoot would as well. Staying in a cave, rock overhang, mine, abandoned structure, or pine groves. Although they, Bigfoot, like other predators, prefer the higher ground, they may stay lower during a storm. Here at my house in West Virginia, the elevation is 1,600 feet. A 5-minute car drive away, the temperature will be warmer by several degrees and half the snow. Drive the other way 45 minutes, and it's 10 degrees cooler and twice the snow. I suspect that food being the primary concern, it's a subject addressed for most of their lives. In most places where a Bigfoot may exist, water is not a concern except for extremely dry periods. Space without humans is primarily the next concern. They can't stay in one location unless there is a food source, as they would exhaust it. For instance, in Ohio, there was a case of a Bigfoot family group that was staying in a wooded area of 1,200 acres surrounded by agriculture. They were in the area a few months, and several local individuals had had a sighting. By the end of their time, there was no roadkill in this location either, as they had exhausted food sources. It seems that they stayed in this location for an inordinate amount of time, and some speculated a baby Bigfoot or an elderly Bigfoot, but who's to say? Since they have learned all the food sources to them in an available area, and we are assuming Bigfoot in this book, there is a comprehensive list in another section. Even there, I'm sure I will be forgetting some. Through Appalachia, deer are overly abundant and can be found most anywhere. In some places of the country, the deer aren't as populated, and asking, "Where are the deer?" as a postulate to finding a Bigfoot may be reasonable, but not in Appalachia. Almost any field in Appalachia will have deer feeding in the evening. In fact, it would make me question what was in the area if I didn't see at least a couple of deer around. So all this being said, I don't believe that the circuit is based on deer at all, rather than other food sources and especially treat foods. I described treat foods in the Tracking the Stone Man book that I wrote a few years ago, and believe we should consider it a reason for a Bigfoot being in an area of a sighting. In essence, a treat food is a food not found commonly. It's seasonal or annual. Examples would be berries, gardens, orchards, etc. It would be most commonly a sugar, since that's so hard to find in abundance naturally in nature. It could be Farmer Blevins' garden, an apple tree somewhere, a place where fishermen throw away fish parts, definitely not something available all the time. I believe they are conscious of treat foods in an area and always around for them. Then they opportunistically kill a deer, eat roadkill, or visit a dump. In Bossburg, Washington, there were many sightings by the townspeople of a Bigfoot that was crippled and seen limping around the town dump. Tracks were cast, and these were paramount in convincing Dr. Grover Krantz that Bigfoot was in fact real. After reconstructing the anatomy of the broken foot on the cast, he believed it unlikely that someone without training in anatomy could have produced such an example. Kleptoparasitism, according to Wikipedia, is a form of feeding in which one animal takes prey or other food that was caught, collected, or otherwise prepared by another animal, including humans, including stored food. Quite a few examples of this come to mind and may be the primary reason that someone believes they have a Bigfoot in an area without an actual sighting. Hunters all over the country talk about deer that they have shot or even already hung up disappearing. It's interesting to note that a few years ago, scientists monitoring grizzly bears found them to be paralleling hunters, just out of sight. The bears had learned to wait for a hunter to kill an animal and then get there first to take it. Surely an animal more intelligent than a bear would learn to do the same thing. In my book, Tracking the Stone Man, I wrote about perches, a term I coined concerning an area where a Bigfoot may safely watch humans or an area. It's always connected to an area of deeper woods and/or provides a route of escape, most commonly a food site, but may also be for protection. When I go to an area, say at park dumpsters, for an example of many, I get out and think about where I could sit in seclusion and watch the area. Usually a couple of spots are apparent that you can go check out. If active, you can find tracks, broken sticks, and other signs that something has stood behind the brush, trees, or rocks. In the course of time, you can find them fairly often with experience. That's one of the first things that I check out in an area to see if it's active. So, in my mind, it looks like this. Bigfoot stay farther back during the day in an area inhospitable or at a place where humans don't frequent. As darkness approaches, they move to the perch area and wait for humans to clear out. Once they do, they visit the dumpster, trash cans, dump, garden, orchard, etc. Probably the most famous example in Bigfoot history of kleptoparasitism is the Ruby Creek incident, which happened in Canada in 1941. A woman and her three children were outside their remote cabin when they saw a 7.5-foot Bigfoot coming down the hill in back and fled to town. The husband and a deputy sheriff went to the location immediately and found 17-inch-long footprints going to the shed and dumping a barrel of fish out. Eventually, it went back to the woods, stepping over a 4-foot fence in the process. Bigfoot is an omnivore, which means it feeds on both plant and animal matter. Bigfoot is an opportunistic feeder. They use their lifetime of knowledge of where food is at different times of the year. He will take food in the form of what's in dumpsters or roadkill. He will kill as he needs to get food. Interestingly, I have seen several cases of what I believe to be a Bigfoot feeding on trash cans at shooting ranges. The ranges are usually located in remote locations, and humans aren't commonly in the woods around them. If you know of a shooting range in a park or large woods, it might be a good place for you to check out. Have you heard that in Subway restaurants in Europe, they aren't allowed a tax exempt for their bread because it contains too much sugar? I think our food wastes found in trash cans and dumpsters full of fast food bags are another source of sugar. They would be as addicting to a Bigfoot as they are to a human. In many places, in parks where people go to shoot or hike or even just sit, they leave their leftovers as a secondary food source. 3. My first Bigfoot sighting. I suspect that most people who got interested in Bigfoot had an experience and got interested, and that's me. If you have read my writings or followed my talks, you know the stories that got me interested. It's rare that I don't do something Bigfoot-related, at least at some point in the day, whether it's communication with a witness, writing or looking at maps, or some days, like today, all three. The last couple of years, the amount of Bigfoot activity I have experienced has markedly increased. You see, I used to be anywhere within 4 to 6 hours of the house, although I was out several days a week.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?